From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
If the state of Connecticut had good fiscal policy, had good business policy, and wasn't trying to kick businesses out, we wouldn't have to turn around and try and keep them in here.
This is former Republican Governor Rowland's second time in federal prison.
Today, as so many generations have before, we gather on our national mall to tell an essential part of our American story.
Let me say,
there's nothing crazy about not letting our companies bring their money back into their country.
This is Secretary Clinton's 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, well, let's start the clock again, Lester.
All right, let's start the clock again, Lester. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Some news of the week, a bit out of context here on The Wheelhouse. John Dankosky with Colin McEnroe, as always. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Let's start the clock again, Lester, sort of in the new What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Kalila Brown-Dean is here. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University and queen of all media these days. Hi, Kalila.
Good to see you.
And Dan Haar is here. He reports on commerce and economics, wealth and poverty, and he works, of course, for the Hartford Current. Hi there, Danny.
My temperament is better than yours.
Don't be braggadocious. Look, if you want to get in touch with us on the website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Obviously, we're going to start with Monday night's debate. We've had a bit of time to digest things. I'm not entirely sure that my digestive system is still working after Monday night. Let's listen to a little bit. Here's Donald Trump talking about one of his big themes in the campaign.
We need law and order. And we need law and order in the inner cities, because the people that are most affected by what's happening are African-American and Hispanic people. And it's very unfair to them what our politicians are allowing to happen.
Now, one of the things that Hillary Clinton was able to bring up and talk about quite a bit of Donald Trump's past having to deal with how he has worked with, let's just say, African-Americans. Let's listen.
Donald started his career back in 1973 being sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination because he would not rent apartments in one of his developments to African Americans, and he made sure that the people who worked for him understood that was the policy. He actually was sued twice by the Justice Department. So he has a long record of engaging in racist behavior.
Oh, my. So there's a lot to talk about just in those couple clips. That was a flavor of what the debate was like. Of course, it started out somewhat, moderately, and then it became a little bit more heated over time. Colin, now that you've had some time to digest what happened on Monday night, what are some of your big takeaways?
You know, I don't know that I have anything to say at this point that is not going to sound a little bit stale. But, I mean, even just looking at this morning's polling, once again, it does appear that it was the kind of night that Clinton needed. Going into the night, it was certainly the case that she was the one who needed to change things. She needed to change the trend line of the polls. She needed to fundamentally alter the conversation. And it's always worse to be in – it's less desirable to be in that particular position. Much easier to feed the fire than to stand there with the fire extinguisher. And she has been largely successful. I mean, the numbers bear that out. We can talk about – we will talk about why that is. But, I mean, if you – one of the things that fascinates me, and we talked about this in my class at Trinity last night, is how we decide who won a debate, you know, because we always do it. Kathleen Jamison from Annenberg says we shouldn't do it. Like, winning a debate is like this crazy thing. People talk for 90 minutes. You know, it's not scored in any particular way the way some kinds of scholastic debates are. But there's a desire to know. And I think part it comes from the networks in some ways. They are effectively selling us, and in their pre and post game, selling an insane amount of advertising money to the concept, or based on the concept, that there will be an outcome. Nobody's going to put on a show that has no outcome.
But it's the same reason why people put on a show that was, I mean, running at the same time as the debate, Monday Night Football.
Right.
People like to watch a debate, Colin, like they like to watch football. They go in with a team to root for. They might just be uninterested observers, but if they are, they want to see hard hits and a lot of scoring and something to root for, and probably people yelling in the background.
Right. And one thing to remember about all this is that just because somebody won the debate, and I think it is, you know, I mean, there's a consensus now that Clinton won the debate. The numbers bear that out. It doesn't necessarily alter the race. I mean, for example, Barack Obama got his butt handed to him in the first debate with Mitt Romney. I mean, nobody questions that. And in fact, there was a poll reversal as a result of that, too. It wasn't a permanent poll reversal. You may notice that the person who has been president for these last 4 years is named Obama, not Romney. And I don't think very many people who are planning to vote for Obama watched that debate and went, wow, he's not that good a debater. I think I probably better vote for Romney. So, you know, sometimes it's a mistake to impute too much meaning to who won and who lost.
Kalila?
Well, I think what came out of that debate was less about changing minds toward Clinton or Trump, but more about getting people who are ambivalent about voting in November at all. So for me, what stood out was in the clip that you played, hearing Trump say we need to bring back law and order, particularly where we are in our country right now, and to recognize that's not just a phrase, it's not just a TV show. It was a concerted effort by the Nixon administration to decimate inner city communities. So I watched the debate and ended up feeling like a unicorn, right? I was an African American, grew up in the South, never grew up in the inner city. I don't walk out of my house and fear being shot. But to talk about those communities, that's where it's centered. So I think it really was a signal to people who were thinking, maybe I shouldn't vote. Now you know what's at stake.
I have to ask, though, Kalila, about that notion of the outreach, we'll call it, that Donald Trump has said he's making to the African-American community. And in this last little bit, he said he's made a lot of headway and a lot of people are coming around to what he's been saying. I guess I'm just wondering what exactly that message appeals to, because on one hand, he is talking about law and order. On the other hand, he is talking about the hell that African-Americans live in across the board. You are an example of many millions of African-Americans who do not come from hell or live in hell currently. So what the hell is he talking about right there? I mean, he's clearly not going to get African-American votes. Is he going to convince people that he cares about the African-American and Latino communities of America?
I don't think that's a signal at all to African-American and Latino communities. I think it is a very determined signal, not a dog whistle, but really a Batman signal to those voters who say, look, I'm fed up with what's going on. And it is a confirmation of how he views those communities. I get upset every time Chicago is used as some metaphor for dysfunction. I get upset when we only talk about Detroit when we're talking about pathology. So if we're going to condemn what's happening in other parts of the country when people are upset, then we also have to condemn when college students destroy property for no political reason. So Clinton, I think, needed to push back. So you can talk about housing discrimination in the 70s. Let's talk about the Central Park 5 case, for which Donald Trump still has not apologized to five teenagers who had their lives ruined, and he called for the death penalty.
But what did come up though is Donald Trump referring to Hillary Clinton's time, speaking of young black men as super predators, Dan. And I think that in some ways that became a thread of conversation that both gave Trump an opportunity to talk to Hillary Clinton a little bit about Bill Clinton's time as president and his role in the mass incarceration of millions of African-American young men. And it also didn't allow, I suppose, for the moderator, Lester Holt, to redirect any of those questions to Hillary Clinton about Bill Clinton's culpability in what we see today.
Nor about the comment of super predators.
Yeah.
She was not asked to respond to that. And if she were being smart, she probably would have said, I was talking about a very specific group of people. You're talking about broadly a group of people. Just want to go back 1 second to the idea of Donald Trump reaching out to urban black voters and saying Democrats have failed you. That's not a new thing in the Republican Party. And its goal is, as Kalila said, is not to get voters, but it's to get voters to stay home. And he doesn't have to do very much of that to change the curve. And there is a significant amount of evidence of that potentially happening, not just urban black voters, but all sorts of Democratic voters staying home, young, suburban women, any number of types of groups. And that's what he's trying to do with that comment.
Tom? Yeah, and you know, it was too late to be incorporated or ingested into the debate prep. But of course, on Monday, the FBI released new statistics from 2015 showing this 10.8 8% spike in the murder rate. And a lot of it is concentrated in cities like Chicago, Milwaukee, Washington, D.C., places like that. You know, I actually thought that I thought Trump had a disastrous debate. He was incoherent for the last 30 or 40 minutes. I mean, he just really, you know, he seemed to get tired and make less and less sense. I actually thought that sort of moment in the middle of the debate was an example of how, in some ways, Trump can be a little bit better than Clinton. Trump, you know, it was pretty clear what Trump was saying there anyway. So you know, there you can sort of say, well, yeah, he's a law and order candidate. And what he's effectively saying is nobody's doing anything about this problem. Now, yeah, I agree with everything that Kalila and Dan have said about why he says that. But nonetheless, you know, you can understand exactly what he's saying. He's talking about all these murders and this crime rate, and nobody's doing anything about it. He's willing to do something about it. He's not very specific about what that is, but it's called law and order. Clinton, I thought, floundered there. You know, I mean, she was trying to talk to too many constituencies at once. So she, on the one hand, needed to send a signal to white voters that she wouldn't be completely enthralled to any other kind of logic or constituency. She then tried to send a message to black voters that she gets Black Lives Matter, that she's read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. You know, and as a result, there was no really consistent vision or theme to what she said. There was sort of some generalities yoked up to some details, but it was kind of a gloppy mess. It was hard to know at the end of that what exactly her take on all this was, at least with Trump. However primitive and crude his take might be, you know what it is.
And out of that gloppy mess, Kalila, there was a moment in which you sort of heard, and I wanted to play back the tape immediately, Hillary Clinton kind of praising Rudy Giuliani's work in New York City around Stop and Frisk because it did make some difference in New York, et cetera. And it was a gloppy mess.
It was a gloppy mess. And I think it's also important to look at the context that both Clinton and Trump were giving these answers. Lester Holt's question at that point wasn't about crime. It wasn't about how we address these issues. It was about racial tensions and racial progress more broadly. So to go to that lowest common denominator and focus on failure and dysfunction, it meant that they both failed on that issue.
In the matter of crime, in the matter of trade, in the matter of economic growth, I was watching, as I was at the Enfield Republican Town Committee, a relatively small but spirited gathering.
Interesting choice, Dan.
And we thank our host at Peerless Machine. Seriously about that.
Yeah.
I found myself wanting to jump up and down and saying, this isn't hard. Say we've made great progress, but we haven't gone far enough in all of those things. And she wouldn't say it. And I'm still trying to figure out why she wouldn't say it. I don't think Colin's explanation that she's speaking to different groups is quite enough. Because it's a tried and true Democratic response that basically Barack Obama built his political career on. We've taken steps. We need to go further. Why didn't she say that?
Well, I think it also pushes back on the Trump slogan about make America great again. Clinton has said America is already great. We're not where we need to be, but we're making progress in that area. Why she didn't say it in this context is problematic. And I think it also speaks to that gap in terms of her understanding of these issues, but the connection to these multiple constituencies as well.
I want to play another clip here. And here's a little section where we end up talking a bit about Donald Trump and his tax returns.
For 40 years, everyone running for president has released their tax returns. You can go and see nearly, I think, 39, 40 years of our tax returns, but everyone has done it. We know the IRS has made clear there is no prohibition on releasing it when you're under audit. So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons.
And she doesn't get into what those reasons might be specifically, Colin. This has come up time and time again. And this is one of those issues where I feel like this debate for me fell short. The first time of many that I may say something about the moderator, Lester Holt, in which we do have a long form conversation about Donald Trump's tax returns. He brings up Hillary Clinton's email scandal and wants her to release 33,000 deleted emails. At one point, Holt does a good job of essentially saying to Trump, well, hold it, this is negotiable now. You weren't going to release them until after your audit is complete, but now you might release them after she releases those emails. But we seem to have no follow-up at all on anything having to do with the big scandal surrounding Hillary Clinton and the stuff she won't tell America.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so I've sort of gone back and forth about Lester Holt. You and I had a conversation about him yesterday. I actually sort of come to a different set of thoughts about him. But, I mean, I do think that one thing – if the Trump camp wants to say that Hillary Clinton skated on a bunch of things, I think they have an argument there that basically she was impressed on calling the TPP the gold standard. And, yes, she got away with a 45-second answer on the emails. In some ways, she had kind of a nice night that way. I mean, obviously, Trump tends to flood the zone, right? He says maybe 15 things that are manifestly untrue. If you're Lester Holt, you figure you can probably maybe challenge five of them before people start screaming. And so that's what he did. I think one thing that he did that was kind of smart, I didn't get this at first, but he didn't really do anything for the first 30 minutes. And people started tweeting, you know, is he there? Is he alive? Put a mirror under his nose, see if he's breathing. You know, and then I think what he did was he thought, you know what, I probably got about five of these that I can do, you know, and I'm not going to do any of them for the first half hour. I'm just going to let them talk because I'm going to need them at the end. They're like peremptory voir dire challenges. It's kind of like I'm going to need them, so I'll hold them back. But there certainly were some places. The other place I would say very quickly is if you were watching that debate and you didn't know anything about this, you would have been forced to conclude, I think, that Hillary Clinton did not support the Iraq invasion. You know, in other words, obviously, she voted for it, and she voted for repeated funding reauthorization.
Donald Trump said it on Howard Stern.
Yeah.
People say lots of things on Howard Stern. And again, he did say it on Howard Stern. He shouldn't say, I didn't say it, because
right.
he did say it. But he said it on Howard Stern. She stood on the floor of the Senate and voted for it, Dan.
Well, that gets to one of the underappreciated themes of this debate, a sort of a second-day theme, and that is his statement, it's just words, versus her later statement, not in response to that, which is words matter. And we who are in the words business are kind of happy to see that somebody believes words still matter. I don't think she drove home enough the point to Donald Trump that words are basically all you have at this level. There isn't anything else. Presidents don't actually do deeds. They speak words.
That's right.
And she might have actually said it that way. But, you know, again, I think we're asking questions about why she didn't say this, why she didn't say this. And her overall strategy was basically to sit there, let him have enough rope to hang himself, and say as little specific as possible. You know, for example, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, which is why, Kalilah, I would expect a little bit more of the moderator. I take Colin's point that maybe we only have a few times in which he can interrupt either candidate. He interrupted Donald Trump a couple different times and forced him, quite rightly, to actually try to answer the question that Lester Holt asked. But he didn't do that with Hillary Clinton. He didn't ask her to follow up on any of these various things that whether it's a Trump supporter or just like a fan of the moderated debate, you know, you might want to see.
Well, I think when Lester Holt was present, he was very present and he did a good job of pushing Trump on that. But this email issue is not going to go away by simply saying, I apologize, maybe I did the wrong thing. You have to address it head on. And if we're talking about transparency when it comes to tax returns or birth certificates or even dash cam footage, then you have to be consistent across those candidates.
I think this was a classic basketball makeup call on the offensive side of the line. He saw of the court. He saw that he had given Trump an unfair advantage by sitting back for the first half hour and letting Trump walk all over Clinton, given Clinton's strategy. So for the second half, he did the makeup call. And
you know,
he realized
– On that words matter thing, I think, you know, you make a really great point there. And I actually thought one of her better moments – and people don't talk about it that much – near the end of the debate where she said, I think, words matter.
Yeah.
And then she said, I just want to say to our allies out there that just because Looney Tunes over here is saying that we're not going to honor any of our treaty obligations, that's not necessarily the case. And I actually thought, you know, John Dickerson says that everything that happens – in a political campaign, the debates are the closest thing to the presidency, right?
Right.
I mean, everything else in a campaign is a lot of theater, pageantry, staging, strutting, posturing. You know, a debate, you kind of have to sit down, at least before Monday night, you would have said, at a debate, you have to sort of, you know, make a certain amount of sense, exhibit a certain amount of gravitas. It's probably the closest thing you can get to seeing somebody being president. So, you know, take that for what it's worth based on what happened Monday night.
I want to move on to one other cut here that gets me to something that Donald Trump talked about that I want to get the panel's reaction to. I'm wondering how it plays in America. He actually talks about something, he uses a word. Well, it's a word that I just love so much now. Go ahead, Kyan.
I am very underleveraged. I have a great company. I have a tremendous income. And the reason I say that is not in a braggadocious way. It's because it's about time that this country had somebody running it that has an idea about money. When we have $20 trillion in debt and our country's a mess, you know, it's one thing to have $20 trillion in debt and our roads are good and our bridges are good and everything's in great shape, our airports are like from a third world country.
So there's a bunch of this, Kalilo, that sort of all runs together. But the thing that I take away at some point in this section of the debate, he talks about how not paying taxes kind of makes him smart. And I think many people look at that and look at some of the other things he said about everything from building bridges and roads to airports needing upgrades because they're like a third world country, or even talking about the money that we could bring back from overseas and invest in the inner city. At one point, he talks about maybe billions or trillions in the inner city. And I think I wonder if we don't pay taxes, how might we get those things built? I'm wondering who will build the airport of the future if it is not through tax dollars, because I don't think people are investing private money in airports anytime soon.
Well, and that for me, I always listen to these debates and my first question is always how? How are we going to do this? And to think about if you brag about not paying your taxes and that makes you smart, how do you have the funding for infrastructure? How do you have the funding for the education programs that Trump says that he now supports? And it isn't just about bringing jobs back to the U.S. It's about making the priorities here and determining how we fund that. Private industry is not going to pay for a really great new airport in LaGuardia. If that were the case, we'd have that already. So I think it's also on his part, it sounds good, but there's no plan.
Danny?
Well, the tying together the repatriation of money with the investment in airports, he believes, and that nobody comes out and talks about these in economic policy terms. But the argument about repatriation is the argument about the 35% nominal tax on corporate profits, which if you lower that, some of that money will come back naturally. That's the Republican side of the argument. And that brings money back into the system, which leads to higher tax returns. I'm not saying I subscribe to this. But you know, he is underleveraged. But it's the idea of connecting those two. He's saying that the airports are going to be built and everything else is going to be built because we're going to lower nominal corporate tax rates, and that's going to do all kinds of good things. That's we actually do have too high. I think both sides believe we have too high of a corporate tax rate.
And I think to Kalilo's earlier question, Colin, how exactly – I mean, this was a debate in which we weren't, let's just say, burdened with an enormous flood of numbers coming at us about plans that we're going to have to pay off down the road. We had almost no detail whatsoever. But that is one of those small details in there that makes you wonder, how exactly will this turn into that?
Right. And you can make the argument that, although, yes, I mean, if you really want to know a lot about the candidates' policies, you have to go do some reading somewhere else because they didn't really talk about them that much during the debate. But, you know, I mean, Clinton is pretty – she did say some stuff that I think indicates – and we do know anyway what some of her plan seems to be right now. And it has to do really with, once again, using taxation to get some of the money that exists as a result of this incredible widening gap between 1 or 2% of Americans and everybody else, and then using that for – infrastructure. I mean, look, the reality is globalization isn't good for enough people. I mean, in the U.S. and worldwide, there are too many losers in this system. And probably the only fix is kind of a, you know, New Deal-ish kind of fix where you basically create more money for the government to spend, probably by going after some of these gigantic fortunes, and then put people to work on infrastructure and building solar panel plants and stuff like that. I mean, I don't see a way out. That's much closer to her vision than it is to Trump's.
Well, you actually that gets back again to the tax rates, is that even Democrats are saying lower tax rates on corporations, which sounds perverse and sounds terrible, make it evenly distributed across them without a huge amount of loopholes, but raise the tax on the super wealthy, because the problem is not global distribution of income but internal within each country. That's way beyond what we were getting at the debate. I just want to really quickly throw out the point that as a strategy, Donald Trump may not necessarily be trying to look effective. I spoke with an undecided voter who is leaning toward Trump, and I followed undecided voters precisely because he looks like, between these two dunderheads, the one who would get the least done.
Ineffective is the new smart.
I'll give you the last word on that, Kalilo.
I don't know
nowhere to go after that. Is that the standard? You know, just pay your taxes. Don't end up like Wesley Snipes.
Okay. We're talking with the very effective Kalilah Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University, Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We're going to take a break, and if everyone has the stamina, we're going to go to another few topics, including John Roland heading back to jail. That's coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Hartford Courant's Dan Haar, with Kalilah Brown Dean from Quinnipiac University, and with our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's in your show today?
You know, sometimes I don't understand how we get ourselves in these situations. Yesterday we did a show about the Church of Satan. Today's show is about vice and about why that idea even exists. Among our guests are Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, who wrote an entire book about vice. Also, while I have the floor, I want to say that Dan and I couldn't force – I didn't even want to try to force Kalilah to drive up here to Hartford. But next Wednesday, we are going to do a part of – we're going to be part of a panel over at Watkinson called Honey, I Broke the Democracy. Also joining us will be Vivian Martin from CCSU and Ross Garber, all around good guy, Republican occasional candidate for things. And – apropos of the conversation we're about to have, former counsel to both John Roland and Mark Sanford at another time.
Are you going to fix the democracy, or just talk about how it's broken?
Mainly, yeah. No, just we're gonna glue it together a little bit. Don't want to be braggadocious, but
Ex-Governor John Roland turned himself into prison on Monday in Otisville, New York, his second time behind bars, most recently for, quote, participating in a conspiracy to violate federal campaign finance reporting laws by, among other things, concocting sham consulting contracts to conceal his role as a paid employee of congressional campaigns by Mark Greenberg and Lisa Wilson Foley. I think the most surprising thing about the timing of this, Colin, is it came almost immediately after you wrote a very nice column about John Roland.
Yeah, you know, maybe I'm getting older. It's the fact I'm going to church all the time or something. But I sort of like I lost my appetite for sending John Roland to prison. And I was certainly among the foremost advocates of it first. Like, you know, I think I started thinking that he should go to prison back in 1994. So it took a decade for the federal government to catch up with me on that one. But yeah, so I did write this thing. And then like the next day he said, you know what, screw it. I'll just go to prison. Rather, because I had offered to sort of meet with him and talk to him about spiritual questions. So I do want to say there's a couple of interesting things to me about this. One of the things is that this all is taking place within against the backdrop of the Supreme Court's recent McDonald decision, in which they basically – I mean, Kalilah talked about unicorns earlier. They basically said political corruption is a unicorn. It just barely even exists. And so the question has arisen, you know, with, particularly in his first case, his 2004 case, would John Roland have met this incredibly high standard that has now been set by the Supreme Court for political corruption prosecutions? I would say yes, he would. He's not Governor McDonnell. He actually signed a stipulation saying that there was a quid and there was a quo. He got stuff. He participated in a criminal conspiracy to award big contracts for a parking garage and a juvenile prison. I mean, he signed that stipulation. So for people who are making that argument anyway, no, I don't think you know, he walks on that one.
Well, I think the consequences here are profound for eroding public trust, for having people say, how is it that he was able to stay out for so long and keep fighting this, especially when we know about the challenges within the criminal justice system for everyday folks who don't have access to really great counsel or don't have that same kind of protection. So I think, you know, given what McDonald did and how the court has seen this, the question will be what's next for Roland? After these 30 months or however long he spends there, what's going to be next, and will Connecticut continue to pay for it?
I think something with Neil Cavuto, maybe. Something in broadcasting, anyway. Way, that's the cycle.
Get a national show.
I like that. I just want you, Ahab, tell me, Ahab, was it worth the fight? Was it worth it?
Nah, not really.
So I just love that analogy. I was under the impression that he still had one more half step to go.
He did.
And so
I
had missed that step, and so I was surprised to see it. But I want to go back to what Colin said last year, or about a year ago, in these very seats. Which is it's sad more than anything else. I don't think this is a lesson necessarily. Yes, that's what political corruption jurisprudence is about, is sending a message. But really more it's just that given his age, you know, late 50s, maybe just about 60, these are supposed to be great years, and he's in great health, good health. And it's just, you know, it's sad to see. I think he could have made an argument per McDonald that the facilities that were built were going to be built anyway. So it's possible that he could have gone that far. But I think he saw the writing on the wall. But more than anything else, just sad.
I just want to quickly say, you know, in terms of these being happy days for political corruption, I think the McDonald decision does point to happy days for political corruption. And, you know, here locally, just 30 seconds to say the dismantling of the program review and investigation staff of the legislature, which was one of the legislative checks on the executive branch. That was not a good thing. Whatever savings they think they're going to reap, and that's pretty putative, the savings that they're going to reap. You know, corruption is expensive. It's really expensive. And inadequacy and ineffectiveness and waste, those are all expensive too. That particular staff was supposedly a check on all that stuff. I would think it's probably some money that we'll regret not spending.
The state legislature meets today for a special session to consider an aid package to Stratford-based Sikorsky. The General Assembly will decide whether to give their blessing to a deal the governor negotiated to give the company about $220 million in benefits in return for a guarantee to produce a new line of helicopters in the state. It would keep a lot of employees here for a decade. Lockheed Monday told lawmakers it will cost about $400 million more to make the aircraft here in Connecticut than the other states they could have picked. But they said the availability of a skilled and experienced workforce was a key factor in the decision. Here's House Majority Leader Joe Arsimowitz and House Minority Leader Themis Claridis from a WNPR story by Harriet Jones talking about this.
Given the parameters of this deal and what it's going to do for the state of Connecticut's economy, how would the supply chain benefits right down the road of $360 million new in investment? It's almost jobs in every community. All the candidates are excited to come in and vote on this.
Nobody likes the fact that we have been pushed into this corner where we now have to make deals with different businesses to keep them here. If the state of Connecticut had good fiscal policy, had good business policy, and wasn't trying to kick businesses out, we wouldn't have to turn around and try and keep them in here. Having said that, there's certainly many people that will be voting for it because, unfortunately, I don't think we have a choice right now.
Okay. Do we have a choice right now, Dan?
No choice at all. This is not about new jobs at all. There is some additional requirement for new spending in the state, but that's something you might have seen anyway when a new program, a new generational program like the CH-53K, that's the helicopter, by the way, that can lift up whole airplanes and trucks and can carry entire platoons. It's three times the size of a city bus. You know, these things are enormous. I did a little calculating last night. Sikorsky could lay off 527 people today based on the number they have in place now. They could lay off 527 people today, keep the level of workforce at that level. You can replace people but not go higher than 525, fewer than they have now, and still collect the full $16 million a year for the first 5 years of this agreement. And after that, it starts to fade off slowly. They have to get back up to not much higher than they are where they are now.
So it's non-negotiable, and we have to do it, but is it a good deal for the state? I mean, here we go. I mean, the governor was forced once again to have this conversation with the press and with Republicans in which he says, well, look, I mean, what are we going to do? We don't want to lose these jobs. But then other people say, well, then we keep getting held up at the door by all of these companies that say we're going to leave.
Yeah, it's a great deal because the question in these deals is always not how many more jobs are you getting and not even the sort of dogma of 3 years ago, which is, how much are you paying per job, which used to be $30,000 to $50,000 and now it's sort of creeping up, especially for the really good jobs. The average job at Sikorsky is $94,000, by the way. But the new question is what was the reality of this work going somewhere else? And in this, that's the question you always have to ask. We think with Bridgewater that he's not going to pick up and move that hedge fund to Florida. We think we're betting he won't. We give him money anyway. Well, let's see what happens. We bet that he does. Here it was a certainty. They built all four prototypes in West Palm Beach, Florida. They were talking to South Carolina. Those two states have been known to give money to this company. There's no question they were going to move this work somewhere else and that the Black Hawk workforce was going to dissipate.
But I think Sikorsky is somewhat unique in that realm of companies that it's very clear that they could move and that it could be a different economic impact. But I think this sets a precedent for other companies to sort of dangle that threat of leaving. So it's almost like building an athletic stadium or not building the stadium, where once you build it, then the team gets into the position of saying, this is why we need the upgrades, or if you don't build us a new one or contribute to that, we'll go elsewhere. So the precedent is set, is this about maintaining the status quo, or is it actually about growth?
Yeah, and I'll just say, Colin, to what Themis Claridis says in that cut, for a very long time, Republicans in the state said, well, if we had a better business climate, then we wouldn't have to go around, or turn around and bribe companies to stay here. I'm not necessarily sure that any business climate keeps a big manufacturer from saying, we want to get out of the expensive Northeast and go to South Carolina, give us money.
In some ways, there's been some excellent reporting about this by, is this Mark Pizniakis, whatever his name is. You know, I mean, look, South Carolina, there's no union. I mean, right away it gets a lot cheaper. It's kind of amazing in some ways that we can keep this company here. I mean, I say that in an ironic way. I think it's, I mean, Kalila, I would agree, but I feel like the precedent got set a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I think Mark in his piece said it's about $80 billion a year. Cash flow, tax incentives to keep, because basically America, as I've said in the past, has turned into a line of gas stations, basically, and you just look at the price and see which pump you want to go to. That's what all 50 states are. I did love the Themis cut, because I love Themis anyway, but you know, she basically said, this is ransom, this is gun to our heads, this is not a good way to operate. Having said that, yeah, sure, whatever.
To clarify, this will pass way overwhelmingly.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And there will probably be, I don't know, 6 or 8 votes in the House against it and you know, obviously fewer in the Senate. This is giving – they're amassing early because the battle today is over whether they're going to bring up other things. Len Fasano, the Senate minority leader, is fighting even now as we speak, I'm hearing – to bring other things into now, not this call for this special session, but the special session that starts as soon as this afternoon, the other second special session.
You're getting texts already about this?
I am.
All I get is angry emails from Larry Cook. You get like informative texts.
How do you know it's not from him?
Very, very quickly.
I'm not angry.
I wanted to mention the speaking of the state dropping a whole bunch of money on someone to do business here. The first flight of Aer Lingus to Dublin takes off today, Dan?
6:10 p.m.
6:10.
I'm still trying to decide whether to catch that flight.
I think – well, I'm sure it's full. This is one where the state puts down a certain number of millions of dollars, a couple millions of dollars to essentially secure this line, defray the costs for Aer Lingus over the course of the first few years. We had a flight to Amsterdam. It went away. Now we're international once again. I mean, now we've got our own flight to Dublin.
Yeah, this is the same thing that we were just talking about with the both of the analogies that Colin and Kalila used. In this case, it's $9 million over 3 years, and it may not all be used. It depends how many seats they fill up. That's 60,000 seats a year, by the way. It's a lot of seats. What do we have now? We have a football team with the football stadium. We have an airline route. We've just talked about we have aviation. We make aircraft, so we've got that. Do we have a beer?
I don't think we have a state beer that the state owns.
Not a state
we don't own
beer.
A beer. We have a tennis tournament.
Yes.
I think we pay enough money to those breweries in Bloomfield. Don't we get any?
Well, they're going to build one near the baseball stadium. So, I mean, should the state be in the business of owning all these things? Kalila, I don't know.
I don't know that it enhances the quality of life at the level. But, you know, Dublin's a beautiful place. I'd like to go, I guess. But I'm not sure this is the priority.
I'm going to hop on one of those flights as soon as I can.
Let's go.
I do just want to say seriously that the chance of this flight succeeding where the Amsterdam flight of Northwest failed in 2008 is greater because not only that we're not in a recession, the airline industry is all finished consolidating and they're acting more aggressively. This particular airline is a very small airline compared to the global players. Aer Lingus has only about 50 aircraft and they are very aggressive about this route as we saw with the picture of Old Orchard Beach that said Hartford across it. They really want people to come to Hartford from Dublin and they're advertising heavily and they're willing to show us Old Orchard Beach.
Look, you spent $54 million on a baseball team that doesn't even play. Who's complaining right now about $9 million to go visit the greatest civilization the world has ever seen?
That is our own Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University. When we come back, we're going to talk about, at this time in American history, the opening of the newest Smithsonian Museum, the National Museum of African American History and Culture. That's next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the week's news with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant, and our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. A few more things to talk about in the week's news. And when the President and First Lady dedicated the newest Smithsonian Museum on this past Saturday, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, it is indeed a momentous time. A lot of people were there. I want to ask Kalila Brown-Dean about that day. But it happens, Kalila, at a time in our history in which it feels as though there is a massive national conversation that is happening about race, about policing, about the way in which, even as we heard in the debate, our urban areas are viewed by people who live outside urban areas. I guess I'm just wondering if you can put into a little bit of context this historic moment, the opening of this museum, in this place in history right now.
I think one of the images that best symbolize the importance of this moment is the picture of George W. Bush and Michelle Obama, because that embrace represents what this museum is all about, that people can go across differences of race, of gender, of region, of political party, and see it as an affirmation of what is so special and so important about our country. It is a way of remembering that pain, of acknowledging it, but also understanding how everyday people have worked to affirm the beauty of really the human spirit, so that in the political context, when we only talk about the pain and the failure, we negate the educators, we negate the artists, we negate the doctors who believed in a country even when that country wasn't willing to defend them. So I think that's why this moment is so important, of athletes protesting, of tensions between law enforcement and community, of really affirming what makes our country what it is.
And it's funny you mentioned that picture, because a lot of people who watch politics very closely, and a lot of people who wanted to see, I think, a better America, viewed that picture of Michelle Obama embracing George W. Bush as what we want to see. And I also saw an awful lot of people commenting on it in incredibly divisive and negative ways. This notion that we're always going to see the worst in the other is something that comes up, and it's not just about race, but it comes up time and time again in politics. And that's another thing that it just feels like we need to get over in some way. And some of the commentary around even that picture may be not as hopeful as perhaps I'd like to be.
So last week I spoke at the Bush School in Texas about race and policing. And I opened that talk with a quote from George W. Bush when he spoke at the Dallas Memorial for the Officers. And Bush said, "We judge other people by their worst example, and we judge ourselves by our best intentions." And I thought that was the sort of the power of this moment, that people can develop a genuine friendship, that it doesn't mean that we forget what they did that was negative or that was divisive, but that we see the humanity in other people. And even in the responses to that picture, I think it affirms this idea that we sort of see people based on their negatives, not based on their potential.
Danny?
There are just so many ways to look at the sort of potential of this. One is, this is part of a trend in which both for museums and broadly in culture, we want validation and we want to know more about ourselves. And there was a lot written when the 9/11 museum opened down at Ground Zero, that why have a museum to that? Because the whole point of a museum is to illuminate that which is not otherwise illuminated. And I think this is in some ways the opposite. There is a lot said and written and talked about in respect to African-American culture, both historically and where it is today and where it's going. This museum is, again, as with the news museum. You know, we get the news if we want it. It's in front of us. Now we need a museum to sort of codify and let us talk about ourselves. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but it's a change in the way we think about the broader culture.
Colin?
I think this is an incredibly good thing. We're in the middle of what shouldn't be a change election cycle. I mean, basically, most things in America are going pretty well. You can point to three or four things that maybe aren't, but basically the Obama administration has had many more successes than failures. But there's this incredible notion of kind of darkness and despair in the land. And I'm not exactly sure where it comes from, but it certainly is incredibly marketable. And if you listen to Trump's rhetoric on Monday night, I mean, it's really all about how everything is so incredibly horrible. So It's nice to see something like this, which affirms, you know, some of the despair of our past, but also the hope of the present moment.
And the unfortunate part about this happening in this week, Kalila, though, is as we see more tapes released from the Charlotte shooting, there's this enormous gulf and this disconnect. And when Donald Trump talks about the hell that African Americans live in a place like Chicago, where they fear being shot by another black person on the street, and then you listen to the people who gathered at a community meeting in Charlotte just the other night, a video of a little girl talking about, tearfully talking about essentially why the police don't understand. This is something that we keep talking about on the radio. We keep not coming to any sort of better conclusion about, but it seems very clear from just these couple incidents of just this last week that these are a few men who would not die if they looked like me. There's just no way to get around that. And that's something that unfortunately doesn't end up in the political debate on the level that we'd like it to be, and it doesn't end up in the national debate in the way we'd like it to be.
But I think this is also a moment for people to take a step back and ask themselves, what do we learn from this and what do we gather from this? So every time I hear Trump say things are worse now for African Americans than ever before, I think about the exhibit in that museum about the four little girls who were killed in a bombing in Birmingham in 1963. You cannot tell me that where we are as a country, as a community now in 2016 is where we were in 1863. So how did communities move forward in that extreme pain when the government took a blind eye to that suffering? We're not there. It's not that the pain is new. It's our ability to capture it, to transmit it across the country, and hopefully build a movement against it.
Well, and equally important, and I don't mean this as a joke, and I hope you agree, is the P-Funk mothership.
I think that's critically yeah. important.
Well, that's right, because the touring, George Clinton's touring, I don't know, what do you call it, an artifact.
Clinton was there and cried
well, that's
at
right.
that opening.
That's right, that's right. And it is a celebration. And the again, to get back to what I think we were saying before, is the strain between celebrating your being a part of a whole and pointing out a separateness is always something that you need to be concerned about in any type of ethnic or national cultural observance. And that there's just a fine line. And I think the mothership crossed over as well.
And how music brought people
yeah, that's
together.
Right. That's right.
It's power.
I can't approve what Kalila said was so beautiful. That was just so great. And Danny makes me think, maybe we got the wrong Clinton running in this election.
Well, you know, George Clinton maybe in the next cycle around. Very quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to mention this Jim Himes story, Colin. In the House of Representatives, Jim Himes cast the only vote against a bill that would give U.S. Olympic medalists a tax break on their victory bonuses, 415-1. What doesn't he like about Olympians, Colin?
He hates America.
Oh,
Why do you hate America? Why do you hate freedom, Jim Himes? No, he's actually right, you know. I mean, this is a cosmetic thing, you know. It's sort of spending money on a feel-good moment. But so I guess you get some props for standing up there. I will say, keep an eye on Jim Himes. You know, people talk about Dan Malloy. Dan Malloy's not going anywhere. But in a Clinton administration, if the Republicans in the House still are in the minority, the Democrats in the House are still in the minority, Himes may wind up in some deputy secretary role somewhere in the Clinton administration.
Any other final thoughts you think you've been thinking about this week,
Maybe
Kalila?
It's just opposition to Ryan Lochte, who, you know, sort of bumbling through Dancing with the Stars.
We wouldn't be going through this if Himes had made the Olympic rowing team. That would be.
I guess that's true. I have to say, here's the thing that I've been thinking about. We lost two sports stars over the weekend. Just imagine this. You're one of the best in the world at something, and you're about 24. If you're Arnold Palmer, you haven't figured out anything yet. You're kicking around between college at Wake Forest and the Coast Guard and an amateur golf career. If you're Jose Fernandez, here's what's happened. You've made a harrowing escape from Cuba after multiple attempts. You've landed in a new country, become one of the most dynamic pitchers in baseball history, blown out your arm. Then you've come back to be even more dominant. Your joy for the game is just obvious on your face and everyone around you who sees you play. So what happens next? If you're Arnold Palmer, you get to turn 25. You get better. You win the Masters and then the U.S. Open, 7 major titles in all. You become the king, and you have Arnie's army, and you stop playing, and you make hundreds of millions of dollars as a pitchman. There is a drink named after you, and you die at 87 having lived a life that we could all just imagine. If you're Jose Fernandez, none of that happens. You die in a boat crash. In a year, you might just win the Cy Young Award. These are both examples, I think, of why sports matters and why it makes us feel. I'm just going to encourage anyone, many of you have seen it, watch the video of Fernandez's teammate, Dee Gordon, honoring his friend and then hitting a home run and then falling, crying into his teammate's arms. You really will get a little bit different view of sports if you just think of it as sports ball, as a lot of people do, Dan.
Yeah, we saw that with Bobby Mercer in 1979, hit the home run after the funeral for Thurman Munson.
For Thurman Munson.
Yeah. It's hard to beat that for everything.
Yeah, and I know, Kyle, we just have a few seconds left. Sports means a lot to you, and this is why it means a lot to me sometimes.
Sports means everything. It brings people together, and it shows what we can do when we work hard.
And I know you talked about this the other day. Colin, any thoughts?
Jonathan McPants and I are right now working on a show about David Ortiz and Vin Scully, two other iconic figures in baseball.
Yeah, coming to the end of the line. A very nice going away for Vin Scully. Colin McEnroe, Kalila Brown, Dean Dan Hart, thanks so much. Also to Katie Tarowski and to Kion Wolf for producing today's show. This is The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.